quite difficult to find a kind of conclusion to this kind of topic. I found that it was a good idea to kind of open the topic with many guest speakers. So Mark is going to start. And so just before he starts, I just want to tell you that you will have an additional speaker coming as a tutorial. So Wolfgang. So he's coming at, it's at 2 o'clock. So he will come and make a 15 or so minute introduction, but also he will be also there to, if you have many questions, because so here, this morning we only have 1 hour and then there is another lecture here, so we cannot stay so much even if you have many questions. So if you have more questions, you will have the tutorial also to ask for time and keep. Okay, so I think that's
it. Okay. Yeah, so maybe I wanted to start because I want to talk about some more classical aspects of the theory, and then I guess all the other small talks will be about things in the quantum theory. And I think that with Maite you did mostly 3D, quantum gravity, so classical and quantum. And probably what you saw is that, so you did the Euclidean case, so most of the construction which you did using the fact that the local gauge group of the theory is SU2. And so it's a compact gauge group, and because of this, you are able to basically carry out the quantization completely. So now the question is, what happens in the Lorentzian case? And also, what happens in the four-dimensional theory? So the world is four-dimensional and Lorentzian, as far as we know. So this is what we ultimately want to quantize. And so maybe you know that the starting point, so the observation, in fact, which led to the idea of loop quantum gravity, it's just a simple fact of algebra, and this fact is that if you take, so now consider the algebra of the Lorentz group, so SO31, and so the simple fact is just that if you take an element of this Lie algebra, you can always decompose this element into a self-dual part and an anti-self-dual part, and this is defined as follows. So you take this element omega, which has these two SO31 indices. So these two anti-symmetric, this anti-symmetric pair of four indices. So this is 0, 1, 2, 3. And what you can do is construct what I can call omega plus minus with an index I. And this is just obtained by taking the rotational part of this object here. So this is just epsilon I jk omega jk. And then here you can put plus minus a complex number I, and then the boost part of this Lorentz element. So the idea is that you take this complex linear combination of the rotational part and the boost part, and this defines this object with only this this index I would be 1, 2, 3. And this is this object omega plus minus. So this is the self-dual, anti-self-dual. So the anti-self-dual decomposition of this Lie algebra element. And so you see that here, essentially what you're doing is you're splitting the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group into two copies of the Lie algebra SU2, but these copies are complex because you're taking essentially a complex linear combinations of boost and rotations. So you can see this as an element, if you want, of SU2, but complexified. And SU2 complexified is in fact the same as the full Lorentz algebra, or is the same as SL2C. So the observation by Ashtekar, in fact, was that now you can take the first order action for gravity, which is written in terms of the spin connection. So this action is just, so depends on some tetrad field and on the spin connection. So this is just star of E, which the curvature of the connection, and then you can take this connection, decompose it into its self-dual and anti-self-dual parts, and the observation is that if you just take the self-dual part of the action or the anti-self-dual part of the action, this is enough to describe completely gravity, in fact. And if you want, the intuitive reason behind this is that you're throwing away half of the theory because you're only taking the self-dual part or the anti-self-dual part, but since you have complexified your variables, in terms of number of variables, if you want, or numbers of degrees of freedom, you haven't done anything illegal, in a sense. So that's the reason for which you can just look at the anti-self-dual part of the action. But then the nice thing is that if you do this, so you get a canonical theory which is formulated in terms of this of this self-dual connection or anti-self-dual connection. And what you can see is that the Hamiltonian becomes polynomial in terms of this variable and the conjugate momentum. And this was the idea for using this complex variable as a starting point for the quantization. But then, if you want to do this, you immediately run into a problem, in fact, two problems. So the first problem is that you don't have, is that you have this C here. So your connection is not valued in the Lie algebra of SU2. So like what you saw with Maite in the three-dimensional case. But now it's SU2 complexified, which is the same as so SL2C. So the gauge group is non-compact and complex. So the first problem is that you have something complex. And so a related problem now is that because the theory is complex, it kind of does not make sense by itself in this formulation. So what happens is that if you look in the Hamiltonian theory, you have to impose a certain set of additional constraints. And these constraints come from the fact that what you want to describe at the end of the day is general relativity, which is a theory of real metric fields and not of complex metric fields. So the idea is that in the Hamiltonian theory, if you start with a set of initial data, namely a real metric, and then evolve this real metric with the Hamiltonian equations, because you have done this complexification, there are some eyes hanging out in the Hamiltonian of the theory. So if you use the Hamiltonian evolution equations to evolve an initial real metric, you want to impose a consistency condition, which is that the metric stays real under its evolution. So what you can do is look at all the constraints of the Hamiltonian theory and look at the Poisson brackets between the constraints and the metric and impose that this is a real quantity, in fact. And if you do this, you will find one condition for this to be true. And this condition is that, so if you do this, you find the condition. So this is what people call the reality condition. And this reality condition is telling you that, so it's going to be a constraint. And this is going to tell you that, so the self-dual part of the connection minus the anti-self-dual part has to be equal to the Levi-Civita spin connection. So this, say, omega plus the complex conjugate has to be equal to the Levi-Civita connection determined by the metric. And so in fact, these conditions are complicated conditions in terms of the basic variables, because as you probably know, the expression for the Levi-Civita spin connection as a function of the metric or of the triad is a complicated expression. It involves derivatives of the triad and determinants of the triad. So it's quite a complicated expression. And in fact, in the quantum theory, no one really knows how to regularize this reality condition and impose it as a constraint on the quantum states. So if you want, for these two reasons, so the first reason is that you have a non-compact, so the algebra of a non-compact gauge group. So if you look at holonomies of this connection, these are object valued in a non-compact gauge group. So that's the first problem. And the second problem is that you have to impose these complicated conditions, which we don't know how to handle. So for this reason, people notice that, in fact, you can find a canonical formulation of the theory, which is really looking very similar to this. But instead of having an I here, you have a real number, in fact. You don't have an I anymore. You have this free parameter. So maybe this is what Meite told you also. So instead of using this omega plus as your canonical variable for the phase-space formulation, you can use this new object, so AI. So this is defined as taking the Levi-Civita spin connection plus gamma times the extrinsic curvature one form. Okay? And in fact, by analogy, you can see that this thing here and this K, these are in fact these components of the original spin connection. So the observation that people made is that, and now this is in fact this is an SU2 valued connection. So the observation that people made is that you can in fact take the Lorentzian four-dimensional theory and write it in terms of variables, so in terms of a connection field, which is a real connection and not a complex connection anymore. And in fact, the change of variable, which allows you to do this, is this one. So maybe Maite told you that initially people found this formulation by starting from the ADM phase space of general relativity and doing a canonical transformation. And then later on, people started asking the question of whether this phase space formulation can be derived from an action, so not only from a Hamiltonian. So instead of starting from the ADM Hamiltonian formulation and doing a canonical transformation to this set of real variables, what you would like to do is start from an action and derive this SU2 canonical formulation from the action. And so this you can... So this you can do, and you can just do by extending this Hilbert-Palatini action by adding a term to it. And what you can do is consider this new action, which is omega plus this new free parameter, so UAG, UHF. So you notice that the only difference between these two terms is that this term here does not contain the, does not have a Hodge dual in front. And you can check that classically, adding this term to the action does not change the equations of motion. And the reason is that half of the equations of motion of this theory are the torsion-free condition. So part of the equation of motion is that the torsion, which is the covariant derivative of the tetrad, has to be vanishing. And this is in fact imposing that this spin connection is the metric compatible connection, so namely the Levitch-Civita spin connection. But then you can check that if omega is the Levitch-Civita spin connection, this term here becomes identically the Bianchi identity. So this is vanishing just as an identity, just as a geometrical identity. So that's the reason for which on shell, this term does not contribute to the equations of motion. Because on shell, or at least on even half shell, on half of the equations of motion, the torsion-free condition is satisfied, and this is identically vanishing. Okay. Okay, so now it seems that we have won lots of things because we have been able to get rid of these two problems at the same time. So namely, work with a real connection and also get rid of these complicated reality conditions which we have to impose in the theory. Because if you work with this connection, which I wrote here, so if you use this Hamiltonian formulation, you get only first-class constraints. So namely, you get SU2 gauge transformations, spatial diffeomorphisms, and time-like diffeomorphisms. So these are the first-class constraints of the theory. So it seems that by using these variables, this has lots of advantages because it solves all the problems that we encountered here. Namely, the theory is real, and it doesn't have these complicated reality conditions to impose. But in fact, this is not really the end of the story, because there is one fundamental difference between these two variables. And this you can see sort of by comparing this self-dual, anti-self-dual decomposition and the definition of this object here. So what we're saying is that you can use this new connection as a canonical connection for the Hamiltonian formulation of the theory, but this does not have a nice geometrical interpretation. Because here you see this decomposition here is a decomposition which is true even if we're not doing general relativity, right? This is just a fact of Lie algebra. And this has, in fact, an important consequence. And this consequence is that if you use this complex connection, there is a sense in which this connection can be understood as a full space-time connection, whereas this connection here cannot be understood as a full space-time connection. So in this sense, this object here only exists on a spatial slice. This object has no four-dimensional interpretation. So one way to see this, explicitly with a simple calculation, so we know that if A is an SU2 connection, So there are two statements here. So if it's an SU2 connection, it means that it's an SU2 valued one form. So because it's an SU2 valued form, it has to transform as an SU2 element under SU2 gauge transformations. So this means that the generator of gauge transformations acting on this connection. So if you smear this generator with some Lie algebra element U and act on this connection, this is just the covariant derivative of this Lie algebra element. So this is just saying that the connection is valued in the Lie algebra SU2. And now because the connection has to be a one form, it has to transform as a one form under spatial diffeomorphisms. And this requirement is that under spatial diffeomorphisms, so if you smear the diff constraint with some shift vector, the action on the connection has to be the Lie derivative in the direction n of the connection. So of course these two requirements are satisfied if you use this SU2 connection, because this is the number one requirement if you want this object to be a connection. It has to transform as a connection under the symmetries of the theory generated by these first class constraints. But then what you can do is also act with the full Hamiltonian constraint smeared with some scalar quantity. This is a computation which you can do, just a computation of Poisson bracket. What you can do is take the total Hamiltonian and smear it with some scalar xi, and then act with this on the connection. So if this object A is a space-time connection, this has to transform as a space-time connection. Namely, this has to be, let me put indices again. I act on the connection AIA. So this is a spatial index. And this has to be equal to AI0, DAXI plus Xi D0A. So this is the definition of being a space-time connection now. So you're probing, in fact, some time direction. So if you act with only the generator of spatial diffeomorphisms, we're only probing the spatial components of the connection. Here we also have information about the time component of the connection. But in fact, if you do this computation with this real SU2 connection, you will not find this transformation behavior. You will find an anomalous term. And this anomalous term is proportional to gamma squared. Times some stuff here. So now by looking at this expression, you can see that, so in fact, already here, you see that you recover the original self-dual connection as a particular case of this connection, just by setting this parameter back to I. And indeed, here, if you take gamma equals I in this expression, the anomalous term disappears, and you find that the self-dual connection is a real space-time connection. But if you insist on working with gamma real and not complex, you will find that this connection is not a space-time connection. Okay, so this is just a fact of the theory. And in fact, as far as I can say, no one really knows if this is a problem or not, in a sense. It's just a fact. So in fact, you should think of these variables as, or this real variable as the only variable with which we can do the loop quantization. Because as we argued, if you take gamma to be complex, then you have a real space-time connection. But then you have these two problems which we mentioned, namely a non-compact gauge group, and you have to impose these additional reality conditions. And OK, maybe I'd stop here. So if you have questions. Yeah.
In this expression, the gamma and the extrinsic curvature, how are they exactly identified with the expression that you had over there? I mean, how can you go from a complex value expression to something which is purely real?
Oh, you mean this gamma here or this?
I mean, the whole how are the gammas in the case identified with what you had over there?
Ah, OK. So the way to do it is that, so if you start with this action here, so indeed, in this action, there is no k and there is no capital gamma. Right? There's only components of omega. And then if you start doing the canonical analysis of this action, you will notice that naturally, the canonically conjugate variables appear to be this object, A. So So exactly this object with gamma really in fact. JK knows gamma omega zero I. And this is conjugate to this E field, which is just this densitized Fayette field. But then it turns out that in the canonical analysis, you still have some second class constraints, which you can in fact solve explicitly. And these second class constraints, which you are going to solve, are going to tell you that the part is exactly this Levi-Civitas spin connection determined by the metric. So you get identically, in fact, you get this phase space formulation. And see that in the action, if you, in this action here, if you take gamma to be complex in this action, then you're immediately doing this self-dual anti-decomposition at the level of the action. I don't know if this answers your question.
So
in a sense, if you do everything with gamma real, then you're doing both cases at the same time. At any point in the calculation, you can take gamma to be complex again.
I want to present you this challenge to get quantum gravity as a theory over all scales. Which of course has something to do that we believe that if we have quantum gravity, we know everything. So it's a theory. And if we have everything, it should basically describe all scales. So the problem of the main problem now is at scale, you know, we don't really know what scale is in quantum gravity because scale is dynamical. And in the end, I will give you maybe an alternative definition of scale from the one which you are used to, and you should have seen, for instance, in your quantum field theory course, that usually if we consider matter action like QCD, you know, and consider the effective action, that in this case the couplings run with your at which you consider your theory, and usually you have a fixed background where you can actually define this momentum scale, K. And here you have your letter meta Lagrangian. So going to gravity, now, you know, add gravity, then this doesn't make any sense in itself anymore. So if at all you manage maybe to define what is your scale as a function of G, where G is now a variable, a dynamical variable. And you see that you get into much more trouble if you want to deal with these things. Okay. So here you can already cook up all kinds of important questions of how to define the running of your parameters in a theory of quantum gravity. The other thing what we are used to is to use discretization and lattice methods, and I believe Mate told you about spinform models, which is based on a discretization. And the reason is if you want to do non-perturbative physics, then lattice models is one of the few methods to do non-perturbative physics. And the usual picture is that you know, you have your scales. So here you are small, and here you are large. And so you don't want your lattice to be kind of fundamental. So what you usually do, you basically discretize and define your model at small scales, or if you do it actually at all scales, but in the end you want to take the lattice constant to zero, to small scales. And then there's this easy job that you have to solve your lattice model, because what you want to do is to extract the physics at large scales. And here you would, you know, check whether this physics you get, is it reasonable? Okay, so that's kind of what you would do in QCD or in any other model which does not include gravity, to start at small scales, because that's where the discretization, I mean, that's, if you go to large scales and you discretize at small scales, you expect that the lattice will not, your details about the lattice model will not be relevant anymore, and you get universal predictions at large scales. Now gravity is quite different. And so, you know, in spinform models in 4D, we define kind of something which then is called kind of a fundamental building block. And the naive picture would be that, okay, now you can build your space-time out of these building blocks and consider things which you know, also go at large scales as they would do here. So the problem, however, is that here you would have actually have a building block which can be of any size. So this can be of any size. So what one usually does in these models is to give an amplitude, or in other words, a partition function, I should, you know, metric as a functional of the metric on the boundary. And if you would do that, I mean, that's what you would do basically in any model. You would basically define your fundamental building block and give a partition function as a function of the data on the boundary. But if you do that for gravity, what you do is you describe, actually, you guess a partition function. And since you can put here any metric, this building block can be as large as you want. You know, it just depends on the stuff you put here. So basically what you do is to guess already that for a particular set of boundary data, for all scales, and so if you don't believe you are a genius at once, you should be a bit skeptical to guess also basically the building block at huge scales, because what you usually want to do is, if you want to have something, a prediction at huge scales, you should first subdivide your building block into many small building blocks and then compute stuff, because you want to have that. You want to maybe lose all the details of your discretization. Because there are kind of many choices you have to do here, and there's not much information we have on these choices and how to do these choices. So you see a fundamental difficulty here is, as I mentioned before, especially that getting even this partition function for even a simple building block, what you reasonably should do in getting this or claiming that you do have that is to solve the theory, because for large data, you should first subdivide your building block. And so that's one of these difficulties we ask in QCD. You would say, I'll go and guess something reasonable, and indeed lots of guesses lead you to the same physics at large scales. For gravity, you basically already to get your partition function for your so-called fundamental building block, it should actually involve solving your theory. Maybe we get. So how can we do that? So solving stuff is always a bit involved. And basically, it's one of these things that in physics, what we can solve is the harmonic oscillators and a few perturbations around it. So we want to have some reasonable procedure to get a bit more information for our partition function. And indeed, saying that at large scales, if you want to say something about large scales, it should actually include a process where you put many building blocks. A procedure which does that is that indeed you accept that what you can do is first to have a reasonable guess of your partition function. For a certain class of boundary data, and that might be the boundary data of a simplex, for instance. And typically, actually, this reasonable guess for this, if you now again look at scales, it comes usually from kind of the large scale. It's informed by large scales. Because we start with the action at large scales, and also, as Aldo will tell you, what we have control over is how this amplitude behaves at large scales. But what you now do is to take actually this amplitude, which you now can also, which is defined a priori for all boundary data, you use it for small scales in the sense that, now I'm a bit abstract here, you basically want to reproduce, compute this Z for fixed boundary data. And how do you do that? You actually subdivide your, say, simplex or any other object you consider more convenient into lots of small pieces. And then you integrate over it. So here you integrate over all inner boundary data, and basically this again is a product over lots of these building blocks. And this is your initial guess. And what you get out is basically a new partition function. If you are a genius, what will happen? Or if you're in 3D, what will happen? is that the new action, the new, sorry, partition function will be equal to your initial guess. So this happens in 3D, and that's why we're actually quite sure that what we have as a theory of quantum gravity in 3D is very reasonable. In 4D, it doesn't happen for the models we have, because we know actually that we have to improve them by using now this procedure, which is supposed to be an iterative procedure. So once you have your improved action, you use then in the second step basically the improved action to get yet another action and so on, and you want to do that until you converge to a fixed point, which basically gives you the perfect answer of what your partition function is. And this perfect answer will be actually, usually it's a quite, I mean, if you put very complicated boundary data, it is basically really telling you everything about the theory. Because this perfect thing, you know, if you can now put arbitrary boundary data, if you manage that to compute for arbitrary boundary data, it basically tells you already everything what you can basically possibly compute about any region which basically fits into these boundary data. And basically this equation tells you that whatever that your final model does not depend on any choice of discretization that you do, you know, by subdividing your stuff into many building blocks. So basically this equation makes sure that you get always the same answer independently in how you compute things, but more importantly is actually that if you have this partition function as a function of the boundary data, you already have solved your theory. And that is basically part of the difficulty, that in some sense, the basic amplitudes we use already have to involve some dynamics. And here, basically, this process is where you have to put in the dynamics and where you have to solve stuff, because here you basically integrate over all these inner boundary data. And now the question is, how reasonable is this procedure? And here I already gave you an iterative procedure. So in fact, that's something which is typical for a normalization flow. It's that you very cleverly only solve for a certain number of degrees of freedom, and you use a solution at every step again. So that's the advantage of it. Another feature which is quite interesting and which I'm not so much commenting on is this kind of, you see that there is kind of a holographic formulation built in, because in the end you are only interested, I mean you are interested in this set perfect, which basically is a fixed point, but this is just a functional of your boundary data. And what you can argue is actually that Z perfect, at least, you know, approximately in a certain sense, is more easily, so it's easy to get for simple boundary data. So I'm basically saying something without much content, because I haven't defined you what I mean with easy and what I mean with simple and so on. but this tells you that you can already get some information without solving for all the details. And hopefully simple means actually homogeneous boundary data, and that already has lots of applications in cosmology. And in fact, the picture is that if we propose this set boundary for some initial building blocks, that this proposal has something to do with a simple class of boundary data, which we then try to improve And we basically hope that we don't change too much the large scale behavior, because that's what we have control over, what Aldo will tell you. And what we actually want to do is to extend our knowledge about the amplitude over all scales, up to small scales. And basically, that's the program I'm working on. OK, thank you.
Why would this procedure of going from set to set prime in iterating converge to anything?
That's a good question. So that's part of the hope that it would converge. But you know, I mean, in mathematics, like these things, okay, so we have some theorems about some things which converge, and we have gone through lots of examples where all these procedures converge. No, because this is nothing else than coarse graining procedure, and it, you know, I mean, what usually happens in physics is that the renormalization flow usually ends up somewhere and doesn't go in circles. Also, there are these examples. It's usually that we do have a renormalization flow which is basically indeed losing information, and therefore there is some way, I mean, that's a kind of physical way that you can hope that you actually converge. Basically, you know, the only alternative is that you indeed go into cycles, kind of.
Something blows up.
Yeah, that's the other alternative. Then you would have to change things. And indeed, okay, in gravity, it should blow up for a certain reason. But this blowing up, usually because it includes integration over diffeomorphic symmetry. But in fact, you know, then you would control these blowing up. I mean, one is gauge symmetries. The other is blowing up maybe because of the usual renormalization issues in quantum field theory. And then you would apply, basically, indeed, think about renormalization procedures there.
Okay, so maybe it would have been better to have this presentation before Bianca's, but since she has a meeting, it was kind of forced to be like this. And so what I want to tell you is nothing as as well established as what Mark has said. It's more like giving you some ideas of what it means and what are the problems in extracting amplitudes in quantum gravity. So it's more conceptual, kind of formal, and the true problem is making what I'm gonna tell you precise and have rigorous approximation schemes to extract these numbers that we would like to compute. So this is a lot about what Bianca has been telling you. So I'm kind of doing the prequel of this. So in quantum mechanics, one knows what transition amplitudes are because so one has an Hamiltonian, one has an Hilbert space, and then transition amplitudes are objects of this type, which are associated to a pair of states and some time interval. Then one can ask, what is the analog of this in QFT, for example? So in QFT, if one has weak coupling at least, one knows that the one important generalization of this object is the concept of S matrix, which goes with a limit at time. So one pushes this time interval to infinity, and one uses asymptotic states. asymptotic states, which are required to be essentially free particles, which are free. While if the field theory is strongly coupled, unless it has some very special properties, what usually one is forced to do is to work on a lattice. And in the case of a lattice, what one is doing is to consider some cutoff procedure, which consists in taking some lattice scale and then shrinking it to zero, or at least to some scale much smaller than the physical scale of interest. So this is what one is used to do in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. So what of this makes sense in quantum gravity? So in quantum gravity, we know that we don't have a real Hamiltonian in the usual sense, which is evolving state, but we rather have an Hamiltonian constraint, which you find a projector on physical state. So the analog of these would be rather something that looks like a physical scalar product between two states is defined by some projector on, well, I don't know if you're used to this kind of notation, so, but it means that your Hamiltonian has become a projector on some, very loosely speaking, some subspace of the initial Hilbert space. In fact, it's not quite in the original subspace either. But, and then one has to see what is the superposition of the, well, how much the initial state or state one has with the projected state two, in a sense. So this is the best we can do. This is very, again, in 3D, one can really make sense of this. In 4D, there are proofs of existency and things like this. They're very involved. It's very hard to work with these objects if one is not dealing with some mini, like cosmology, where one has very few degrees of freedom and dealing them essentially quantum mechanically. And one doesn't have a QFT for real. So while in this other picture, we see that we're kind of lost. We don't know what going to infinity in the time direction means, because we don't have a priori a meaning of a way of measuring time for any possible geometry in the middle. So we don't have this limit. It's not necessarily very, very meaningful starting with. And also, we have the problem that to talk about this asymptotic state, we need a concept. Well, in QFT, there is a nice concept of free particles moving on a background. This doesn't make any sense for a metric which is defining our spacetime. And again, for lattice, there is a cutoff. A cutoff usually is some small length, but if this length becomes dynamical, then what does it mean? It's not clear. So we see that the usual story has problems, and there is one last. There is, however, one last situation which I didn't mention, where things are well understood and are more similar to gravity than all these businesses. These are topological quantum field theories. So in topological quantum field theories, what one does is one has a like d-dimensional manifold, which I will call B because will be the boundary of our region of spacetime. And to this, one associates some Hilbert space, some vector space at least. So, and then to every manifold, whose boundary is given by B, to any co-boundary M, one can associate some number. I don't maybe it's better in the other way around. So, which is the closest we can get? Well, which is an amplitude? So this usually is formulated in a quite a formal way, talking about coboundaries, associating some vector space to the space of the bees, and then and so on. But in fact, this comes from a nice path integral picture, which is very useful to keep in mind, and which will enable us to make contact with what we know and to what we would like to have in quantum gravity. So the typical example is this amplitude is obtained by integrating some fields with some connection on M. So the theory is such that these integrals do not really depend on the geometry, but just the topology, so that all these quantities can be kind of made sense of and usually better defined via some other procedure. And this is very sketchy in any case. But what is nice here is that we see that what we're doing is to work, should have drawn something before. So what we're doing is replacing a picture like this, where we have some interacting region here, and then free particles coming out and registering on our space slices at t equal minus infinity and t plus equal plus infinity. Here, what we are substituting this with something which looks more appropriate for a theory of quantum gravity. So we have a finite region, M, and then we have its boundary. We're registering information all over its boundary and asking what is the amplitude of this object. So this can, in principle, make sense for all these theories. It makes sense for field theories, for quantum gravity, and for topological field theories. So obviously, it's very delicate to define such objects rigorously. It's very hard. But what is important is, in my opinion, is to understand how this solves the problems that I was mentioning above, like having this picture in mind. So for example, this problem of defining an infinite, like this time interval in this way, how is it resolved at this level? So at this level, what we have is the metric field defined all over our boundary, which is the region we can control. For example, if you have a box, we want to do an experiment in this box. What we can monitor is what is the metric outside the box for all time? And then we do a measurement in the inside at the beginning and at the end, and we have, and this defines something, some region like this. So this is our box. And these are the boundaries of the box propagating in time. So, and we can monitor what is happening on the outside for all the time. And now, by monitoring this, we have access not really to the time parameter in the bulk, but we don't care. What we know is that by measuring the metric on the boundary of the region, we can, in principle, well, it's what we do all the time. We have our clock, and we know how much time has passed on the boundary of the region. And then we know how big the box is and stuff like this. So we have access on the boundary to all the quantities that we need to talk about physics, to talk about scales. We don't have access to them in the bulk. But in the bulk anyways, everything will fluctuate enormously and we don't care. So this idea of doing field theories in finite regions like these by using the Lagrangian formulation in the path integrals was hidden somewhere in a paper by Dirac, in a very old one, which Feynman talking to, well, he read this paper at some point because someone suggested it to him, I don't remember whom, and then he was writing his PhD thesis at that time. So that's that comes from very far away, in fact, from the early days. So, and the last thing I want to mention is that these, in principle, should allow one to extract the semi-classical limit, to have a way to talk about the semi-classical limit here. And the idea is that now, if I have a reasonable way to put a semi-classical boundary state, so a superposition of matrix, which is semi-classical, on the boundary of the region, this should allow me to extract the semi-classical amplitude and find back, for example, in some limit at leading order, the Einstein-Hilbert action on the classical solution, so the Hamilton-Jacobi function, function of the boundary fields. So, in two words, what one does is to take H. Well, this is probably very very trivial. You shouldn't, but okay, I will repeat it anyways. What one knows how to do is to take some spinform model, which one guessed in some and constructed in some ways, and usually it is defined in terms of some variables, which are the areas of the or the length of the different building blocks, depending on the dimension, and then one takes these areas to be very large, and one claims that this is the semi-classical approximation. So nobody has in mind to take tetrahedra the size of this room and takes them seriously. What is happening, though, is that what usually plays the role of H-bar in a theory of pure gravity is, in fact, 8 pi g h bar, which is the Planck length, because there is a g down here. So this is what is defining the discretization scale, rather than the discretization, the regularization scale of the theory, as much as h bar is doing in quantum mechanics. And the semi-classical limit of quantum mechanics is at least the naive one that by Bohr and Sommerfeld is to take the limit of large quantum numbers, which is we take h bar to zero while keeping h bar times, the unit of action finite. So here the unit of action, we don't talk about action anymore, we talk about areas. So we want to keep areas finite while taking the regularization scale to zero, which means taking very large areas in dimensionless units. So this is what one is doing. And if one does it for Ponzano-Rage, one finds the action of 3D gravity, rather than the action, the Hamilton-Jacobi function of 3D gravity on some region of space-time emerges. And in 4D, there are some models able to do this for a single little chunk of space. So whether this is enough to have a well-defined semi-classical limit? Probably not, because there are all sorts of issues that come out when you try to stack many of these together, many divergences, and in fact, this connects to what Bianca said before, and understanding how this works requires much more work, in fact.
one short question, and then Laurent is going to conclude this. Any questions here? Shall we go to the conclusion, Laurent? No. So, you can see the
Where do I put that? No way. Okay. Hello, everybody. So I guess here you're all kind of interested in reality in some way, and this is what I want to talk about. I don't want to talk about quantum gravity because it's a word that is already bringing to mind lots of prerequisites. So let's say the question we are after is putting together gravity and the quantum. Okay? And, you know, and the question is, can we put these two things together? And it's very important. The first thing, if you remember one thing about what I said, is that this is an open problem. And this is why we need you. And why I'm insisting that this is an open problem is that when I was in your situation, you know, Humpty Dumpty years ago, early 90s, I remember, it was the early 90s. And, but it's a long time ago. And it was in print everywhere. And people told me that the problem is solved. So there's no way to think about it. The problem has been solved. There was a theory solving it. It was string theory. And I remember at the time, it kind of annoyed me deeply. Because any time I was trying to ask some questions, I would not get the answers. But I didn't really have the tool. And all the people I trust in that field were telling me, well, you know, I don't see your problem because the problem is solved there. So the first teaching is that, which applies only if you're working in quantum gravity, right? In any other field, you should not do that. But, and I'm sorry, Maite, but it's not against you. Okay? If you want to work in that field, don't trust anybody. Okay? I'm serious. This is the theory is played with belief systems. And the reason we haven't made any progress is that people, you know, exhibit these belief systems into strong hypotheses. So, you know, there is a reason that, you know, you should apply that with lots of caution. Of course, you should trust me. You know, it doesn't mean that you should not trust the messenger, but you should always. What's happening in this field is, you know, you make a simplifying hypothesis because you need to work through something. But you should always remember that this is a simplifying hypothesis. What happens, it's a basic fact of psychology. Person A make a simplifying hypothesis, then gets a result B, then the result B get repeated by C, you know, and the simplifying hypothesis is forgotten. And in psychology, it is a fact that if you repeat something, even wrong, many times, people believe it's true. There are many experiments like that, where they say radically wrong statement, everybody knows the wrong statement, then they run it through newspapers in university for long enough, and then they ask the question before and after, and you know, before everybody says it's wrong, and after everybody says it's true, okay? Okay, so what it doesn't mean that we haven't learned anything in quantum gravity. I think we have learned tremendously, okay? And I think you're coming at the right time where somehow, you know, we have constructed different models and we have certain things in quantum gravity, which is now a good time to kind of step back and put it together. So let me tell you what are, you know, I think are the challenges in this business. I would say I can see four, and you have been taught some of. So one is, let's say, why do we have different belief systems? Okay. The first one, it comes back a long way, which is that somehow there's a divide in gravity. When you think about quantum gravity, whether it's really about matter or whether it's really about geometry. And this divide goes along, you know, it's a very old divide. It goes back to where science was invented, you know, Democritus. You know, which is, and you go down to particle physics. and string theory, okay? So this is essentially the things that really matter is primordial. And in fact, the mere notion of space-time doesn't exist in itself. What exists is the space of motions of objects in it, and this is the space of motion that defines space-time. And if you want to understand the structure of space-time, you should understand matter and quantum matter and how it moves, okay? And that's a very, I mean, these two points of view have been standing side by side in physics for, you know, as long as science was invented. So they are very robustly ingrained and solidly established. But when you start to think about quantum gravity, they start to clash with one another. So this is this. And then the other point of view is, you know, Newton and Einstein. You know, and then there are other people along the way. It would be an interesting discussion to where you put Leibniz and where you put Lagrange, and you know. And then let's say we LQG, okay? So the fact that they are based on, for instance, to give two examples of, let's say, competing technical models of why, you know, they seem to have completely opposite message or different message, is that, of course, their premise is radically different. LQG, as you have been explained, focuses on trying to understand the geometry of points or local objects independently of matter, like understand purely the quantum geometry of geometry, and that's going to be a part of what quantum gravity is. Whereas, you know, string theory and derived model try to say, well, look, we're going to have to modify the notion of probes, okay, and then we work our way from there. I mean, clearly, what my take on that is that we have survived. This is why it explains why quantum gravity is hard. Is that we have survived long enough? If you pick any other field of physics, you can decide which side you are on. I'm on this side, and then you don't have to worry about the other one. It's just philosophical, blah blah blah, okay? And you don't care. But if you're in quantum gravity, you have to decide. And in fact, if you start to decide, you're going to be wrong. So the challenge is that it's clear that quantum gravity is some kind of unification of matter versus geometry, and that's why it's hard. Because the type of theory we have built so far are based, let's say, GR is based on the right-hand side versus quantum field theory, which is based on the left-hand side. Okay? The second thing that you're going to face, so knowing that beforehand is a huge advantage. Okay. The second thing I would say is you've seen that, so you know, versus continuum. So clearly, you know, there's clearly something, you know, in the LQG approach, there's clearly something discrete. That appears from the onset, and this is how you imagine somehow quantum setting up, and this is maybe one of the, I would say, robust results that is going to stick from this type of approach that focuses purely on geometry. But even if you look at the other approach, whether it's asymptotic safety or string theory, the common theme appearing in any approach of quantum gravity is non-locality. Okay? So the big challenge is not only that you want to unify these two perspectives, but is that you want whatever you're going to do, whether it's because it's discrete, whether it's because your probe are extended, whether it's because it's quantum, whether because it flows a lot, you're going to have to face the challenge of thinking about physics or organizational principle that organizes physics in terms of in the context where there is some amount of non-locality. Okay, and I could say more about what people, you know, do besides LQG there. Now, and in LQG, this is really what Bianca was talking about. Okay, you have discrete objects, but you want to recover some notion of continuum. So, you know, built-in notion of discreteness is like a built-in notion of non-locality, but that doesn't completely disrupt entirely what you're used to. And that's a big challenge. Now, the main thing is that, in some sense, there's something that we are just now realizing about gravity, is that in some sense, gravity is a purely kinematical theory. What do I mean by that? I mean that really, what are the equations of motions of gravity expressing in the Hamiltonian language? They're expressing diffeomorphism invariance, which is the statement about a symmetry. And what we have understood in the in the past 10 years, and we're still in the process of understanding, is that essentially the meaning of diffeomorphism homomorphism invariance is a notion that gravity is holographic. What does that mean? It means that suppose you want to compute the energy in a given region, okay? So usually for any physical system which is non-gravitational, there's a bulk component, and then there's a boundary component. The bulk component, and then there's a boundary component, which depends on dr, right? And what happens is that this is an extensive quantity, so you know the boundary component is negligible with respect to the bulk component, and then you worry about trying to figure out what are the local degrees of freedom. Okay, that's phi theory without gravity. What is the story with gravity? It's beautiful, it's exact opposite. The bulk component of any gravitational system, so gravity tells you, this is the expression of Diffeomorphism invariance, that the bulk doesn't exist. And therefore, the only form of energy that you can register is the one that the boundary observer sees. Okay? So, you know, thinking of physics in this language is a challenge, because you're used to think that things are defined locally and exist locally, and the form of energy exists locally. So now we have enough. We understand that this is really what Diffeomorphism invariance means, and that understanding this corresponds somehow. What does it really mean to have a formulation of physics where the bulk doesn't matter? This is what gravity is about, and that's the same thing as understanding the dynamics. In the sense that, you know, the expression of the energy being vanishing is the expression of the dynamics of GR. The bulk energy vanishing is the expression of the dynamics of GR. So we have certain examples, and you know, ADS-CFT was the first one to really kind of nail down. But in fact, even before people say that, before, you know, precursors like Toft. We're as usual, quite amazing in trying to find out, but I don't think we have really processed out what it really means, okay? Because what it means is that it should be true anywhere. It should be true in your mere formulation of physics, and of course, it's related to non-locality, okay? Because if you have a non-holographic formulation, it means that you have to, and this is the key to understanding the proper formulation of non-locality. And then the fourth is what are the degrees of freedom? Okay, understanding the degrees of freedom. There are lots of things that are coming recently, you know, entanglement entropy. And I think right now it's a great moment to start because there's a big shift happening. Not only are we understanding that, you know, that we have to give rid of the bulk, but we're also understanding more deeply the shift of the degrees of freedom. So what is happening? What have we done in the past, let's say, month? I'm sure that, and it goes back to the first thing. Okay, if you have any course in GR, or read any book in GR, you will see a statement like, black hole have no hair. What do you say? No classical hair. How many of you have seen that statement?
I hate to ask you to wrap up, but we haven't
looked at that. Okay, I'm wrapping up.
Thank you.
So, who has seen that statement? Okay? This statement is wrong. Okay? This is a statement you can find, repeated for 25 years, and this is what we recently understand. We understand that black holes have an infinite number of hairs, which are this observer hair, and it goes back to the beginning of this thing, which means that we are now, for the first time, understanding what are the degrees of freedom at play in quantum gravity.
Okay, so I think we have to stop here. Thanks a lot for...